Were you born in the UK or were you born elsewhere?
I was born elsewhere.
Where were you born?
In Lahore.
In Pakistan?
Pakistan.
And then, do you want to tell us about your childhood first, or do you want to and talk about your family, or do you want to tell us when you came to the UK and why you came?
I came in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
I just done my MBBS, and I came with my first husband to train further here to as a doctor.
Mm.
And that's when I came, and he. So we stayed here for 3 years, and then went back.
Right.
In 71.
71.
And then I had my daughter, Mariam.
And by here, you mean in Oxford?
No. Different parts of England. My right. first job was in Brighton. Then we lived in London. Then we went moved to Huddersfield.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the last place
right.
before we went back to
right.
Pakistan. And then I went back and I had my daughter there in October 72.
Mm-hmm.
But my marriage started failing.
Mm-hmm.
I could see that it wasn't going to work. So I came back when she was only a few months old.
Right.
To keep my residency here as well as the work here. Stayed here for a year and then went back again to sort out my marriage, and but this was still not working.
Mm.
So I came back again after a year. I can't remember exactly when I came back, but maybe a year, and came back. Left my daughter with my mother and came alone to this time to sort of make my career. Look after my career, because the first time round it was my husband who was doing his specialization, and I didn't get a chance to finish what I wanted to do. So I came back and decided to do hematology. First I came to Manchester, stayed there for a year. Then I moved to Oxford, and since 1976, September 76, I've been living. Oxford has been home for me.
So why did you move to Oxford?
I moved to Oxford because I wanted to be near London but not live in London.
Mm.
And I wanted a good centre, and a medical centre. So Oxford had a good medical centre.
Which one?
The Oxford Royal Infirmary. It was the Royal Infirmary that I came to. And moved from the Royal Infirmary to the John Radcliffe, the new hospital as well.
Right.
So stayed there for quite some time for all my training. And then I met my present husband. In 77 I met him, I think. And that is when I got divorced as well. You know, it took a long time to finalize the divorce. And so... In 77, I think I met him for the first time. He was a student here, but we were just friends.
And he was a student at?
St. John's College.
Right.
And so I got involved with all the Pakistani students.
And he is Pakistani.
He's Pakistani as right. well. So I got involved, and that's where I met him.
Okay. And you've been living in Oxford ever since?
I would say yes, apart from a few years when we went back to Pakistan when my mother was ill.
Right.
But we've always had a home in Oxford.
Oxford. But and have you ever lived in another country besides the UK and Pakistan?
Yes, my husband worked for the UN. So for 10 years, I half lived in New York and commuted to work here. So I used to work in England 3 days a week, and 4 days I used to live in New York.
Right.
But I always had a home here to come back to.
Right.
So I was we were called Nylons, New York-London commuters.
Is that a term specific?
There's a TV program about nylons.
Oh, I didn't know.
New York, London commuters.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Someone told me that, and I didn't know that.
I've never heard of it, but that's very interesting. Okay, I'm going to look it up.
And NYLON, London. So nylon.
Nylon, yeah. NYLON. Yeah, that's funny. So, Latifaji, just a few things. I just want to go back to, you know, that time when you met your husband.
Mm-hmm.
So you said you became involved with Pakistanis.
Mm-hmm.
By that, do you mean, you know, they were Pakistani students? How did you get involved? What did that community mean to you?
Well, there's an emotional link to the place where you come from.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who you always want to keep in touch with that community. So, although I had lots of British English friends also in my with my work, but you always seek them out. So
yeah,
that's how. If you want to know exactly how I met, how I got involved with the student community, because I was older.
And this is so this is in particular the student community at the University of Oxford, or just different places in Oxford?
Student community in Oxford.
At the university.
Yeah.
Right.
Can I answer this?
Sure.
Okay, you can stop the recording.
Yeah. I have resumed the recording on both devices. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you were telling me about your involvement with the students at Pakistani students at Oxford University.
Yeah. And I was going to tell you the story about how I got involved with the student community. I was with my, maybe I should say that or not, with my boyfriend.
Right. Anything you want off the record, you can just tell me.
It's okay. I'm not touchy about these things.
Yeah.
In a restaurant, and there was a Pakistani girl who had very long hair, and I knew she worked in the television there.
Pakistan.
And so we had a bet. I said, she's from Pakistan. My boyfriend said, no, she can't be from Pakistan. So we had a bet.
Mm.
So I went to talk to her and ask her if she was from Pakistan. And she said, yes, she was from Pakistan. I won the bet.
Mm.
But that's how I was introduced. She was a student in Oxford, and she introduced me to the rest of the community.
Ah, and this was in the late 70s. Okay, and then you became like
part
these,
of their group. So.
And this was your primary group of friends?
I would say not primary, but extended group of
extended
friends.
Extended. But you became close to them.
Yeah, I became close to them.
So do you want to just tell us about, you know, what, like the little things, like where did you hang out? What did you guys do?
Oh, yes, I will tell you a lot about where we hung out. The Oxford Royal Infirmary was very central.
Acha.
It's on Woodstock Road, and next to it is Brown's Restaurant.
Mm.
And our bleeps used to work in the restaurant. We used to spend a lot of time in the restaurant, even when we were on duty.
Right.
And with friends as well, the hospital friends and university friends would also come, but we would hang out and there. And there's a bar, pub opposite also, the Royal Oak, I think it's called.
Mm.
We used to hang out there as well quite a lot.
Are there any places that you notice that, you know, that were frequented especially by Desi, like South Asians or Muslims or...
No, I was determined to not join the South Asian ghetto.
Right. Do you want to expand on what you mean by that?
That, you know, I found that lots of Pakistan, South Asian people just meet the South Asian people and don't mix with the local community. And I had made a conscious decision that I will mix with them.
Right.
And try and amalgamate with the local population more. Of course, my roots are Pakistani, but I would identify myself as a British Pakistani, British of Pakistani origin,
right,
and mixed with everyone. But not everyone was like that in the community. If you go, you know, I'm talking of North Oxford, where there are no labor class is not on this side of the city, so there weren't many people who weren't associated with the university or the medical profession on this side.
You mean in Summertown?
In North Oxford.
In North Oxford. Oxford.
In South Oxford, there were lots of people from Pakistan who I got to know, because I would go shopping there for grocery shopping, etc. And they were, you know, they respected you, they look up to you. But things have changed now. They don't look up to you anymore, because they feel that, you know, they've lived here long enough now to have their own standing. I don't know how to explain to you, but like the shopkeepers, etc., were very respectful that, yeah, I'm a doctor and come from Pakistan, and they would feel proud of me. Not anymore, because they've made a lot of money now. They're rich and they don't feel anyone is any better than them or anything. So which is good.
Because you feel like you've seen the Pakistani lot of upward mobility
in the Pakistani
community over the last, you know,
50 years that I've lived
here. Okay. That's also interesting in terms of, we talk about, you know, the last 50 years. Let me first ask you that, you know, if it's okay to ask you, what role does faith play in your life? You were born into a Muslim family. So over the years, you know, you identify as a Pakistani British Muslim?
Yes, I was a religious person for a long time.
Right.
I used to pray, and I've read the Quran several times. But I'm a self-taught Muslim. Because my parents didn't ask me to, you know, to read the Quran through a Maulvi or to have an interpretation. I always had discussions with the Maulvis on lots of controversial issues.
You mean the Maulvis back in Pakistan?
Pakistan. I would always say, for example, I would say, Sharab is not haram. It is. It's not something good, but it's not forbidden. I would say there are only four things that are forbidden. If you've read the Quran, you would probably know that dead meat. It's haram. What is? There are four things now. Let me think. They're not coming to me. What is haram? Dead meat. They call me Yad Niara. I will come back to this.
Okay, that is perfectly fine.
It's not coming to my mind. I'm getting old, so it's not coming to my head. It's a simple thing. You should know.
Honestly, it's not.
Blood, dead meat. Or anything that has been killed in any other name.
Okay, I'm not even sure about this, to be honest.
They're sort of said forbidden to you.
But you would have these, and this is when you were a teenager.
Teenager, yeah.
And where would you meet these Maulvis? Like, as in, you mean like people who are conservative in social settings, or just...
Who claim to be very religious, and yes, in social settings I would come in contact with, and I would have a discussion with.
So
them.
Very early on in your teen, you started having
these conversations, right. with people who are religious. That look, this is wrong, and this is not forbidden. It's not a good thing, and being drunk may be forbidden, but not alcohol.
It's the state, you're saying.
It's the state.
But not the consumption.
Not the consumption. If you don't get drunk, it's okay.
So what made you think about these? So you're saying that your parents didn't sort of impose this religious education on you.
No.
And you said you're self-taught Muslim.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, because I lived in Pakistan where everyone was a Muslim. My father used to pray, my mother used to pray, but they didn't impose it on us.
And you grew up in Lahore?
We grew up in Lahore, and I would read the Quran in English.
Mm.
I read Bikthal's translation. And I would read it, I would hide it, read it in bed under my rizai.
Why would you hide it?
I don't know. I just felt that it was, you know, I didn't want people to know that I was reading it. I don't know why I used to read it secretly as a kid. That maybe I would be sent to a Maulvi or someone. I don't know if someone found out. But no one said anything to me. But I read it in English. And I would read it. And then I would, whenever I opened the Quran, I would say to myself, God, make me understand it properly, the right way, what you want me to understand. And so I always felt very confident that I know what it means, because I've asked God to guide me.
And this is all as a teenager?
All as a teenager.
Can you tell us a little bit about your family? Like, how many siblings were you, and a little bit about your parents?
Yes. Now, my parents, it was a mixed marriage. My mother was a Sikh.
Okay.
But she converted to Islam.
Okay.
Because of the children. That's my mother.
She's lovely. And your
father, my father. This is my father.
This is
them together. This is my daughter. And that's me and Omar.
That is just, this is in Oxford?
No, this is in London in a nightclub. We had just been married recently.
Latifa, she looks stunning. And that is?
My sister, who's passed away.
Okay, so, I'm so sorry. So, you were telling us about your mom was
a Sikh, and she married a Muslim, and she converted for the sake of her children, she told me, because she believed that, because she was religious. I asked her, why did she change her religion? And she said, I felt I'm worshipping the same God. If there is a God, it's the same God for everyone. The only thing that has changed is the method of getting him, to reach him. The way you pray is different. Otherwise, it's the same God I'm worshipping. And which has stuck with me forever now. Because I think that is the truth of it. And religion shouldn't fight with each other. Our God is the same for everyone. And rituals might be different. But I also feel that people need rituals in their lives as well. It gives them some kind of belonging.
I'm glad that you touched on belonging. And I'd love to talk to you more about that in Oxford also. But so, tell us a little more about your parents. When did they meet? Where did they meet?
Now, it's a very interesting story if I tell you more. My mother was married to the Maharaja of Patiala.
Okay.
And she was only 16 when she was married to him. But she didn't tell us anything. But I overheard the story when she was narrating the story to a friend of hers. And I pretended to be asleep.
But she hadn't never told
Never anyone. Told us about the story. That she pretended to sleep. That she, when she went to the palace, she found that he had several concubines. And one day she went to the for a walk, and she saw a woman hanging herself from the tree. And that day she decided she's not going to live here. She's going to leave him, the Maharaja.
Mm. This is before, this is around...
Before partition. This is around early 40s maybe, mm-hmm. or late 30s, right. or early 40s. So she asked her father to get her out of there.
Mm.
And so the father went to court to get her released because the Maharaja wouldn't let her go.
Mm.
And she says that if the British weren't here, then he would have killed me.
Mm.
And not let me go, leave the palace. But because he had to present me in court,
mm.
he couldn't kill me. I was in solitary imprisonment for a long time. And he would come and ask her quite often, what do you want? Why do you want to leave me? I give you anything you want. She said, I just want my freedom. I don't want anything else. And this was a story in the news, big way at that time. So my father, when he saw the news, he wanted to meet the woman who became a commoner.
Hmm.
He left the palace to become a commoner, so he wanted to meet her. So someone introduced them.
So he sought her out.
He sought
because
her out.
He saw
the news that this is someone who's just left the palace. So he sought her out, and then he married her. Then they got married, and but didn't tell her that he was already married.
Your dad,
my dad.
Fair.
So then my dad had been married for 10 years but didn't have any children.
Okay.
So then she became pregnant and had a child. But she said, I had decided, when I found out that he's been married before, she found out that I'll have the baby and then I'll leave him also because he's lied to me. But the first wife, then when she saw that she's got a child, and she hadn't had a child for 10 years, decided that it's time to leave because she will be more important because now there are children involved. So she herself asked for a divorce and left my father.
Right.
So then my mother stayed on when she left.
So this was all in Lahore?
All in Lahore.
Hmm.
So stayed on with my father, and then they had four children.
Where were they when partition happened?
In Model Town.
They were in Lahore.
They were in Lahore, in Model Town.
Did they ever have like stories to tell you about it?
Oh yes, lots of stories. My mother couldn't see. My father had lots of Hindu and Sikh friends.
Hmm.
And they even thought of moving to India with their friends.
Hmm.
Because they felt that most of their friends had left and gone to India. Because Model Town was a very nice area to live. There were all kind of religions lived there in peace and happily. And it still is the best, I think, what should I call it, a community in Pakistan, residential community in Pakistan. Because it was structured so well that they have not been able to destroy it. There are not too many, you can't build too many houses there. There is a certain plan that you have to follow. Although they've divided the plots, they were very big before. But okay.
I'll pause the recording. I've resumed the recording. Acha, so you were telling me about your parents. And you know how they met, and so partition Lahore mein rehte the
before partition they met, yeah.
But aap us waqt bata rahi thi ki Lahore mein wo log rehte the aur partition ki unhone aapko kya stories batayi thi. So what
my
the kind
mother,
of stories they told?
It was horrific, you know. People were leaving their homes, leaving everything behind. My mother couldn't see it. She saw so many Sikhs being killed.
Hmm.
So she went to Hyderabad Dakkan, where my father's brother was living. So she just went away for a few months to be there while the killings were going on. But they were very affected by it because they had lots of close friends.
who they also, you said, at one point considered moving to India, because their friends
moved, so they wanted to move with their friends.
So what I'm getting is that they had friends from a lot different religions.
Yes.
And you know, and you said that Model Town at that time was a place where all religions and communities lived, all religious communities
peacefully and happily.
So let's just carry that forward. And so when you grew up in Pakistan, you spent your you were there until your 20s?
21 when I came here.
What role did, you were telling me about your own religious education, but in the home, what role did religion have?
Being a good human being was more important in our home.
Right.
Than saying our prayers or talking about religion or, you know, advertising as the Muslims are doing now.
Hmm.
Religion was a personal thing in our home. It wasn't sort of imposed on anyone. And I seeked to read the Quran myself because I was in Pakistan. And that was the only religion that was being practiced around me. So I chose to be that and started reading the Quran and started praying also. But I had a very different relationship with God, because the way I've approached religion was that I felt that he was a friend of mine. I could talk to him. He was a if I didn't do well in my papers, I would ask him to change the paper for me. You know, it's a childish thing to ask, but you know, it's that kind of relationship I had with God.
Did that change after you moved to
England? Yes, as I grew older, I moved away. The relationship with God hasn't changed.
Hmm.
It still is the same, but about religion has changed. That I feel that if there was a God, as religion says it is, that kind of a God, then I used to say, if I had that power, the misery that's going on in this world, I would do something to change it. Why are people starving in Africa, for example? So I felt there is no, you know, I felt there is no God in that sense, because why is there so much misery in the world? Yes, it is probably a crutch, I felt, for as people need a crutch, but an existence of a God who will punish us for doing bad or good sort of went away a little bit.
Do you think that had to do with you being in a country other than Pakistan, or like being in a country in the UK?
No. I was brought up with an open mind. With the mind that all religions are the same. So even if I was in Pakistan, I would have been thinking like that in my head. That, you know, if you have power, you don't let children suffer. If I had power, I would do something about it. So why is God just watching it? If he has all the power.
So, but you do you still identify as a Muslim?
I identify as a Muslim, yes. I still pray to him, and he still listens to me. It's a strange thing that, you know, I feel whenever I pray, there is an answer to it. I don't pray very often because that faith has sort of gone a little bit, but sometimes when you're desperate, you do pray. But he does listen to me and sort of answers my prayers, but I still feel that it is your conscience, your own vibes, which are probably... I'm still a spiritual person, and I feel that after the AI and the internet and everything, I feel there are vibes going around. If all that information is in the air around you, there are vibes, good and bad, and if you think bad, bad things happen to you. If you, you think good, good things happen to you. So I've moved from the old religion to this kind of
spirituality. I mean, while we're talking about Pakistan and you growing up there, do you, other than religion, you know, what kind of memories do you have growing up in Model Town? You know, friends, school.
Yes, I have lots of memories. I was very young when I became a doctor. I was only 20 years old.
And you went to university in Lahore?
I went to the medical college in Lahore. I had to increase my age because I was only 15 when I joined the medical college. And you have to be at least 17.
So you started medical college at 15?
15. So, so you know, but my memories are playing with dolls also when I was younger, and all good memories. I was the youngest in the class, treated by my fellow students in a very nice way as a little kid rather than an equal. If the girls wanted something from outside, they would send me.
So you were the youngest in your class?
I was the youngest.
How come?
I just was, my elder sister was only a year older, and we were admitted to school at the same time, so we were in the same class, so I was always younger than her. Then she was dyslexic, and no one diagnosed, now I'm saying it afterwards, but she would fail, she was very bright, so our parents would move us to a different school. And be, so that she doesn't go behind me, at least she's with me in the class. So, so I that's the reason I was the youngest, because I was put into school earlier with my elder sister.
And
maybe I jumped classes also, but I don't remember when. When that double promotion was done or what happened. But I have always been with my sister, so...
And this medical college, was it all girls?
All girls college, yes.
What was that like?
It was nice. It was nice that it was an all girls college. I think it was very relaxed. I had good friends and I was not... I never studied very hard. But I was good. I listened in the lectures. More than studying, so that way, and I used to sleep a lot. I, the last few years, I was in the hostel, and I used to sleep a lot. So the junior girls passing by, because we used to sleep outside in the summer.
With the hostels.
Hostels. So they would watch me and say, if this girl passes, then everyone will pass. Because she's always sleeping. So they were good times, yes. They were really.
What was, do you remember everything, anything about, you know, the politics of the country, who the leader was, you know?
I remember.
What people used to, or grown-ups used to talk about at home in terms of politics.
Yes, I feel that it was a much liberal country then when I was there, and people were much more freer.
This is before East Pakistan, separation of
before
East Pakistan.
Before East Pakistan, yeah.
So this is when Ayub was...
I even think, yes, Ayub Khan was there maybe, yes. Around that time.
Around that time.
Yeah, even before, probably, I'm talking of. It was a freer country, more liberal. I remember as a teenager or even younger, in the middle of the night, we would go out on bicycles in Model Town and without any fear. We didn't have any walls in the houses. There were only hedges. So there were no gates to protect you. But now it has become a very difficult country. Everyone's built walls in the houses, and they don't know what's happening outside. While when I was growing up, anyone could come into our house. Doors were not locked, and it was a much more comfortable place to live in.
So, coming back to, you know, your move, So when this was this in, is it okay to ask an arranged marriage?
No, it wasn't an arranged marriage, because my parents didn't have an arranged marriage. So my parents didn't know how to arrange a marriage either.
So you knew that your husband would be moving to the UK and you would be moving?
Yes, I think he was my second cousin, and he was a doctor also, and he brought up in Karachi, but he moved to Lahore to do his FRCS exams. The British exams were being taken in Pakistan. The first primary exam was taken, so he had moved there. So that's when I met him properly, although he was a cousin, distant cousin, but I got to know him then. And so I thought I'd fallen in love with him, but I think it was more a physical attraction than anything else.
And when you found out that you're going to be moving to the UK, how did it make you feel? Were you excited? What was going on?
I was excited. I was, it's a dream to travel for everyone. So I was excited. We came. We had £100 in our pocket only. And we came and stayed with our friend and had lots of experiences in that first month when we were looking for jobs.
Was this in London?
No, it was in Manchester, because my ex-husband's friend lived in Manchester. So we went straight to Manchester. So we had some kind of a support system. But we had lots of experiences in that little time.
How was it seeing, people, as a young woman, like coming out of Pakistan, seeing people of different races and religion and this new environment? Newly married.
I came from a background which lived like this, like the British in Pakistan. Our elite is influenced by the way of living of the British. So I came from that background, so there was no change as far as I could see in the way of living.
Right.
People changed, people were different. And it was a good experience in lots of ways.
Were you ever treated, discriminated against because of being? I know it's been a long time, so we can talk about it in phases when you first came and later on. But when you first got here, were you discriminated against, or were you ever made to feel?
Discriminated, I wouldn't say. I have never felt discriminated personally against. But there have been incidences where people have resented our way of living. Like when we were staying in the hospital accommodation our friends had arranged for us. If we were cooking, then once a nurse came running to the kitchen and threw our food away.
And this was Pakistani food?
Pakistani food.
And by our way, you mean South Asian or
South
Pakistani?
Asian Pakistani. Yeah. The smell was so strong. And I don't blame them for it, because they were not used to it. And our smells are strong, so we should have been not cooking that kind of food in there, I think. We should have respected their ways. I feel that we also owe something to the, when we come to a community, to respect the ways they are living. In our own homes, we can do what we like. But if we are in a common ground, then we have to respect their ways, is what I would say.
And anything other than that, you saying you didn't feel discriminated against, but any other such instances where, casual, everyday racism?
I don't think there was racism against us. I think if you were doctors, it was a different thing. If you, it was a class thing.
Absolutely.
I think In Britain, it is a class thing, the racism.
Hmm.
Because I will tell you an example of that. That when my brother-in-law married an English upper-class woman, there was a lot of resentment. And then his sister-in-law once said, at the wedding said, oh, you can't go wrong if someone's been to Oxbridge. Because Uma's brother had been to Oxbridge. But I always said then that if she had married a lower class Englishman, it would have been worse for them than an upper class Pakistani. I felt that class was more important in Britain than race.
That's very interesting that you bring that intersection of race and class.
Mm.
So then let me ask you how people from other, Pakistanis of other classes, how you have witnessed discrimination against them in Oxford? And what kind?
In Oxford, or you want to know about England?
I mean, you can talk about England more broadly, but specifically Oxford.
Because I live in the North Oxford, I haven't faced any discrimination. I feel it's again the class thing, that the type of people, more respect educated people, and it's a mutual respect for each other. But the discrimination comes, if I look at Britain, is because of class more. Because the people who came from Pakistan in the 60s were from the villages. They hadn't even seen a big town in Pakistan. They were flown straight from there. And there are lots of stories at that point of they hadn't even experienced how to wear a trouser even. You know, I remember once in the plane, one man was walking in distress up and down the plane, didn't know what to do, and someone asked him, why are you so distressed? What do you want? He said, I've never peed. I don't know what to do. I never worn a trouser, and I don't know how to pee. So he didn't know that you have to use a zip and open yourself and go. So, you know, things like that. So there were people of a different class who hadn't seen anything.
And they had to
adjust to the different things here.
So in your experience, your class privilege kind of shielded you from a lot of that.
A lot of that.
That racism.
Yeah.
And
I'll tell you another story, what happened. That, you know, one of my colleagues in Huddersfield said to me once, let's talk about discrimination here. There's no discrimination here. There is discrimination in Pakistan. I said, what? He was a bit dark. So he said, at least the white women speak to me here. In Pakistan, any woman who was fair didn't even talk to me. He told me a story that he was coming back from playing cricket and he was wearing the white white clothes and following some girls in the tonga on his bike. And the girl said, it seems as if he's stuck in yogurt. A crow is stuck in the yogurt. Kabab hazawa dahi mein. You know, that kind of discrimination, that a girl who's fair doesn't even speak to a black man. So we have our own discrimination in Pakistan. Prejudices. I would not say prejudices, not discrimination. Prejudices in Pakistan.
And so, you know, you've been in Oxford for 5 decades now.
Mm-hmm. Nearly.
How are you part of the sort of, do you have Muslim friends? Are you part of, you know, some kind of, you know, society, or do you go to the mosque or anything like that?
No, I don't go to the mosque.
Mm.
But I have lots of Muslim friends who are here from Pakistan. I'm friends with them. But why I don't go to the mosque, one reason is the way the religion is projected by them is not what I want to associate with.
What do you mean specifically?
They're not liberal enough for me.
Hmm.
I feel that we are living here. For example, I'll give you that in the mosque they have segregation.
Hmm.
Women sit separately and men sit separately. And I feel there's no segregation in this country and we should not have segregation in the mosque. And it's time that we put our foot down and change these things.
Hmm.
Because otherwise they'll never change. But the money is being given by, I shouldn't say this, but I feel it's been given by the countries which are very conservative, like Saudi Arabia. So they have these clauses built in for their funding. And they are the ones who are creating these terrorists or fundamentalists in England.
So in Oxford specifically, how have you sort of seen the Muslim community or the South Asian or Muslim community sort of change
over the decade? I think the changes come more in the south of Oxford,
hmm.
where there were different class of people.
Mm-hmm.
who were working in factories and had small shops of their own. They have changed. But the older generation have found it very hard to change because the children are wanting to change, but they're pulling them back. They want them to be live like they were living in Pakistan. And that's causing a lot of problems. That's caused a lot of problems all over Britain, I think. With the view they, especially with those cases, you must have heard of those men who were charged with grooming women in Rochdale. And then there were even in Oxford there is a group of men who was charged with grooming young women. There's an inbuilt thing of not respecting non-Muslim women being taught by them to them because they dress differently. So, that way they've gone the wrong direction because of the parents' pressure. I don't know how to explain this to you, but this is what has generally happened that in a household, boys are treated better than the girls, and they're told that they have to marry. These white women are not good enough for you. They're easy to take to bed, and they don't have any morals. Morality is only one thing for them, nothing else. So, and the women are treated badly also by being suppressed. So they behave in a different way at home and behave outside differently. Several families have probably experienced that they go out and take their, if they're wearing hijab, take that off or dress differently when they go to school. And then they have a different clothes with them to change when they go out. Which is sad, I think. And the parents need to be educated a bit more about which they're learning the hard way, but it is still a major problem in the community, I think.
What do you think? What do you think it means to be a Muslim? In the UK in 2024?
What it means, I think UK is...
So you talked about how it intersects with class.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but it's generally, in UK, you're not forced to follow a religion.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do whatever you like. It's a personal thing for me.
No, so as in, not just you, but, in terms of Islamophobia and racism... Or not, whatever you think means socially.
It is Islamophobia is there because it's been misused by certain, as I said, the people who are funding these groups are funding them to say non-Muslims are not going to go to heaven and, you know, they're not good people. So generally the feeling of hatred is being spread by the religious leaders. And that is one reason that I don't want to go to the mosque, because it happens there. That the wrong things are being said to people. And when I first came to England, and they were allowing illiterate Maulvis to come, they were giving them visas to, because there were no trained Maulvis here. And even at that point, I said they shouldn't let them come in. They will spread the wrong things. We need to produce our own religious leaders here, or religious teachers here, who are educated. But no one listened to me. I was saying that Britain shouldn't do it. But they were giving them visas to come and run a mosque or whatever, without any qualifications. So that was the wrong step that Britain took, which I feel has backfired, because these are the people who have trained these people to become hate the non-Muslims in the country, and so that has created Islamophobia as well. You know, there is Islamophobia, but the Muslims are also to blame in creating that Islamophobia. So it's not one-sided.
In terms of, you know, your Muslim friends in Oxford, so do you feel like you're part of this community, or
you mean the British community, or like, just
you know, sort of like the Pakistani or Muslim community in Oxford?
I am part of that Muslim community, because I think every student who comes here has some kind of connection with me. Sometimes I've probably helped them in some way or the other.
Like how so?
Well, a friend of mine once said to me that she met someone in the bus, and she said, "Where are you going?" And she said, "I'm going to Latifa's house." She said, "You know, every student knows Latifa, so you know it's kind of thing that I help people. If they don't have accommodation, I'll say come and stay with me, or I help the community in that way. That if they need any kind of help, so." So most people know me in that community, and I feel part of it also. But at the same time, I feel part of the local community also.
And when you say local community, you mean?
Now, I don't know whether it's a racist thing to say the white community or...
No, you mean like people are different races?
Different races, yeah, different races.
Races,
yeah.
And... You know, what kind of activities do you do with the Muslim community that you mentioned? Like, are they Eid things, or
of course,
iftaris at Ramzan or some?
No, I have Eid parties in my house every year, and everyone comes. So,
is it a big thing?
It is a big thing. Everyone. You know, now I'm getting older, so someone else sometimes does it, so I quietly accept it, that, you know, you do the hard work of organizing it. But usually it was me who was doing the Eid parties, but I also do Christmas parties. I also celebrate Easter. I have a Christmas party also. So I'm different in that respect, that I feel... My justification for that is, a lot of people say it's not in our religion. I say, okay, Christ was a prophet of God. We don't call him son of God, but prophet of God. So if I celebrate my birthday, I can celebrate the prophet's birthday also. So,
So just, you know, I'm trying to get at like traditions and food, etc. So let's say, you know, on Eid, do you make food from your childhood? Do you have recipes that you've been passed on in the family from home?
I don't know. I learned cooking in England. In Pakistan, you don't cook yourself, so you don't learn. So I'll cook. They're my own recipes, but I cook Pakistani food on Eid. And I cook a turkey on Christmas. So it's a household which follows all traditions.
And does your family from Pakistan visit you often? Your brother was here when I... And so... You know, how connected are you to your...
Very connected. I am very connected.
So where is everybody?
One of my brothers lives in New York. One lives in Pakistan. And my daughter, my sister's children live in Pakistan.
In Lahore?
In Lahore. But we are very close family.
How do you stay connected? FaceTime?
No, I don't get that, stay that connected. I'm not a person who's... phoning and texting, because when I'm my life here is different and I'm busy with that, so I can't sort of lead a double life at the same time. So I call them once, maybe once in a month. You know, some people are very good at calling up now that these things, gadgets have come up, but I don't believe in social media, so I...
You're not active on Facebook or Instagram? No, none of that?
Not active. But although I think I should get involved now. Because things are changing very fast. And one has to change. But I don't know how long I'm going to live now. So
very long. So, you know, when you came here and all these years, how often do you go back to Pakistan?
I used to go back every year before, maybe even twice. But since my parents have passed away, it's become a little less. But now there's so many weddings that I'm going every year.
Every year. And how does it feel when you go back?
I enjoy it. But I enjoy it. If you stay at home, it's fine. But when you go out, for a few weeks, I just feel so depressed with the environment. No one looking after the poor. The situation every time I go is getting worse and worse. And I feel that poverty is getting too, you know, rich are getting richer and poorer are getting poorer. And no one is bothered. So that sort of hurts me. And a lot of people say, why don't you go back to Pakistan now? You'll have a much more comfortable life. I feel that my conscience doesn't allow me, because no one is doing anything to improve Pakistan. And here at least I know everyone's fed. I sleep in peace that, you know, there's no one starving in my neighborhood. All children are going to school. Anyone who's ill is being looked after. So it's a much nicer society. So at the end of my life, I would much rather stay in a society which is fairer than an unfair society. I will die in peace here than in Pakistan.
So this Oxford then is your home?
Oxford is my home.
How, you know, what do you like about the city?
It's got everything you want.
Like what?
Like theatre, cinema, so many things going on, music. And nice people, young people, which the students are always there. Yeah. So young people, you interact with young people, stay young like that. And it's close to London. You can go out for an evening if you want. So it's a wonderful place.
What's your favorite part of the city?
I think the colleges are my favorite part.
Do you have a particular college that you really like?
I like Keble College.
It's close by, right?
Yes, it's close by. It's behind St. John's. Do you know where St. John's? It's behind St. John's.
Yeah. So, when you were working as a doctor, was your work always you know, when your husband moved to New York, did you ever work there or was it always here?
Always here, because, you know, you need to pass the exams in America. And when Umar went, he went for a year only, so I didn't think I need to do the exams.
So what was it like, you know, working as a doctor
here?
In early days?
Early day. Oh, it was great. I've worked in the NHS for 52 years. So I'm a unique doctor who's worked in the old NHS and the new NHS. Because I didn't retire early. I carried on working, although I retired at 60, but carried on working until 2 years ago. So I was working, I worked for 52 years, so which is a lot. So I saw all the changes. So I mean, I do want to sort of talk about my experience in the NHS.
Yeah, I'd love to. Please do.
I want to, you know, it was sort of perceived to be the best in the developed world and the cheapest as well. And I felt when Margaret Thatcher tried to change the system, I felt that something which is the cheapest and the perceived to be the best in the world doesn't need to be changed. You know, we need to find out what's wrong. I said perceived to be the best because there were problems with it and they needed to be addressed. But we should have identified the areas which needed to be changed and not shake the system. And now it has become a 9-to-5 kind of job for the doctors. It's become totally different from what it was.
How is it different?
The culture has changed. Before, the doctors owned the NHS. They cared for the patients. The patients were satisfied. I'm not saying they'd never made mistakes, but it was always done in good faith. And patients still respected the doctors, even if something wrong was done. But now it has become like the American system.
How so?
That, you know, people are just wanting to know if there's something wrong been done and suing, the suing culture and the tick box culture has come in, which is, means you just tick the boxes. You don't care whether the patient is happy with you or not. You're just ticking the boxes. And if that's happened, you've done your job and gone home. While before, the doctors really cared. If one of my patients was ill, sometimes I couldn't sleep at night because I would think about how they were doing or what the doctor I left on duty is managing them, etc. So you really cared and worried about your patients. Now that's gone. It's just a job. You do it and go home.
So what do you think is, what are the reasons for this, these changes?
Because the culture has changed. Because, you know, before, I looked at it quite seriously myself. I felt that why was this cheapest in the world, developed world? Why couldn't other people replicate it? If it was so good. I found that the reason was that the doctors weren't willing to join in as easily as in England. What Bevan had achieved was that he'd bribed the doctors to join the NHS. Bribed in the way that he told them that they will manage themselves. No, so they managed well for 30 years. Now it was time to change, but the change could have taken a different form, not the form that it took. Lots of waiting times where people were complaining about waiting times, etc., which were minor things which a clerical assistant could have sorted out. You didn't need big managers to come in and do. The main problem with the NHS was the money. The new treatments were coming in, which were very expensive. And No one knew where the money was going to come from. And I felt the government needed to be honest with the public and say, look, treatments are getting expensive, and how are we going to fund this? And my solution was that the primary and secondary care should be free for everyone. Tertiary care, the people who had above a certain income should join a insurance scheme within the NHS and pay into it for tertiary care, which is the expensive one. And the people who can't afford it, the government pays for. So there's money coming into the NHS from apart from the taxes, which is an insurance scheme within the NHS.
Right.
Which could have worked, I think. But because governments didn't want to change the policy of no payment for healthcare from birth, it's the state's responsibility from birth to death, kind of thing that Bevan had created in the NHS, that they didn't want anyone to pay into it. But I think being frank would have been better. And I think people would have accepted it more. And the problems are the same even now. Mm. Waiting times and not having enough money to have enough people working.
Were you still part of the NHS during COVID?
Yes, I was part of the NHS.
Can you tell us, you know, when COVID, when the pandemic started, what were your first thoughts? What kind of, were you going into work? What were you seeing?
Well, I was working because of my age.
Hmm.
They'd let me work from home. So, because I was a vulnerable person in their eyes, so I was working from home. But I felt that the staff, the NHS staff, worked very hard.
Mm.
And without considering their own health. And a lot of doctors and nurses died at that time. But it was a crisis which they dealt with quite well. But the government didn't deal with it well, I think. I could see a lot of, which are being investigated now, so I can't sort of say very much about it, because there was no supply of gloves or masks and things like that that were needed in the hospitals to protect them. So there were several reasons, and I think every crisis teaches you a lot of things. How to manage it the next time better. This was a crisis which happened after a long time, so no one knew.
So when did you retire?
I officially retired when I was 16, 2006, but carried on working.
So when did you stop working?
When did I stop working? In 2022, I think.
Okay, and you know, do you want to talk about your life after that? What is it that keeps you busy? How do you spend, you know, you sort of your everyday life? What do you enjoy doing? How do you, what do you do in the city?
Well, in
at home and outside the home.
Oh, I go to the theater a lot.
Hmm.
I have lots of friends that I have lots of dinner parties at home. I have been helping my husband write his memoirs.
How has that been? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, that's been tough for me because I'm not very computer literate. And I'm amazed that I've achieved it.
So just for some context, do you want to tell us a little bit about your husband and why he's writing, he's written his memoir?
My husband has written several books. He's contributed a lot to the development literature.
He's an economist. And he was with the United Nations?
Yes, he was teaching in Oxford and then worked for the United Nations.
When was he teaching at Oxford?
He was teaching in Oxford from late 80s to 96, when he moved to New York.
Late 80s to 96. And then what made him decide to, do you know?
Is that something you are
comfortable talking about?
Yeah, I'm comfortable.
We can sort of tie it into the memoir. And you're right. So, do you know what made him decide to, make that switch from teaching to an international organization?
Yes. He was working here in the Oxford University, and they had sent him on a conference to Bangkok. And where he spoke, and then someone from the UN heard him speak, and they approached him and said, we would like you to join the UN and come and help us with the newly developing Eastern European countries who have, they need help in development, so if you could come and help us. So he thought it would be a good experience, so to move and help some countries getting practical experience of development rather than just teaching.
So then his memoir is about all, his time, obviously his early years, and his time teaching in Oxford.
Yes.
That's part of the memoir?
Yes, everything is.
And what's it called, the memoir?
It's called Traveling Uncensored.
By Omar
Noman. Omar Noman.
And, of course I'm going to read the book, but what does he, and you helped write this book?
Because he's become disabled now, so he can't write or use the computer anymore. So I've helped him compile it, organize people. He spoke with some people who wrote his stories. Then I have put them together in order to give it structure.
How was that? I enjoyed it. How was the experience?
It's given me a different a skill, in a sense, that now I want to write my own memoirs. And I want to write about Shaukat Khanam Memorial Hospital, which I've helped build.
Oh, you played a role in that?
Yes, my role was very important in that. I was the first project director of that that trust.
Oh, okay. So would you like to talk about that?
I don't mind.
So let's finish up about the memoir. So that is something that you've been doing after you stopped working with the NHS.
Yeah.
And this is about,
it's about Omar is bipolar.
Right.
So he's had a difficult life, but a very good life. So that's what he's trying to say, that look, you can have several difficulties in life, but you can still be happy and be productive. So if you ask him, he will say it's about his inner thoughts and his outer life, because that's why he's calling it Uncensored, because it's a truthful story about his mental health as well.
So the book launch is going to be in Oxford next month.
Next month,
And in this memoir, he talks about, does he talk about his coming to Oxford and as a student and then teaching?
Yes. It's about...
So the city has a role in the book.
Yeah, of course. It's very important where he met the love of his life, he says.
Yes, of course. And it talks about your marriage. Would you want to tell us about how you met? Or is that personal?
No, he's written that in his memoir. So
do you want to tell us?
I can tell you about it. We met at Somerville College. It was a Pakistan Students Association's dinner, which was organized, and I was invited. And that's where I met him. But initially, I didn't feel he was a prospective husband because he's 10 years younger than me. But we became friends. And, then at his, what is it called, graduation or when you finish a degree, what's it called?
At the graduation ceremony?
No, it's a graduation ceremony is separate where you get the degree.
Yeah.
But end of exams, there is a special term which I don't know. I took a bottle of champagne. That's a tradition. Friends bring a bottle of bubbly to celebrate your finishing of your exams. That's when something developed. But I always thought it would be just an affair. But Umar went back home after a month and asked his mother, told his mother that he was in love with an older woman who had also had a child.
Mm.
And she kept quiet for a while and then she asked him, do you love her a lot? So he said yes. And she said, you should marry her. So he came back and asked, proposed to me. That's how.
Did you get married in Pakistan or in Oxford?
In Oxford.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, the sort of the get-together? Was an intimate wedding, was it?
It was a Pakistani standard, a very small, maybe 80 people were there, but it was a very fun wedding, I would say. In Pakistan, the weddings are not for the couple to enjoy, it is for the guests to enjoy, but here we enjoyed a lot and it was much more fun.
So, you know, you and your husband both came here at a very young age and stayed.
Mm-hmm.
But you see a lot of people, you know, come here, study or teach and leave.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time when you, you know, in the 70s and 80s, did you notice that the Pakistanis or Indians or Muslims who were coming here, did a lot of students stay on in Oxford?
Muslims, you're talking about the Muslims?
Muslims or South Asians or, you know.
Well, if they could, they wanted to. But most people had jobs back home.
Like, you know how people move for jobs to bigger cities, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
So did you notice that, you know, a lot of students at the South Asian students or the other Muslim students, did they stay back or most of them?
They stayed back for different jobs, but not in Oxford.
But in the UK.
In the UK or America, World Bank, mm-hmm. economists just went to World Bank or even the UN, but mainly to the World Bank.
A lot of them didn't stay back in Oxford.
Not in Oxford, yeah.
So anything, before we
But
talk,
there was a problem in the university, which I felt that the Muslims were not given job in the university so easily.
Oh, you noticed that?
Now when I look back, I can see that happening.
When is this?
Maybe in the late 90s.
Late 90s?
Yeah, because there was a friend who wanted to stay and he was promised a job, but not given the job at the last minute. Indians were preferred more than the Pakistanis.
And you're saying that this is something you noticed in the 90s?
I noticed in the 90s, but I won't say, you know, it's an odd case that I know of, but still I feel there are not many Muslims in the university.
In faculty position?
In faculty position.
Do you think that's changed recently or no?
Not really. But it could be because our education system is so bad that they're not trained well enough to come and join here. But there could be different reasons for it. But there are fewer Muslim members of the faculty. Then maybe Hindu or Hindu or other religions, I should say, not or other races even.
Before we move on to your work with Shaukat Khanum, is there anything else you want to say about, you know, the theme of this project we're working on, you know, the community history of Muslims living in Oxford, or anything else about your life, or anything you want to add?
I would say that it's a very good project, and I feel it, what it should highlight is the life of the Muslims as it being ruled by the few fundamentalist Muslim. For example, I will say I've always noticed that there is a Muslim council in Britain, and I feel they're all very, they're not part of the community so much. They do not, they are people who are of, who have been, I think, bought people from different governments, who have their agendas, and they want to show the religion in that light, not promote the welfare of the community. While I feel that we Muslims should be becoming more liberal, more forward-looking. We live in a liberal country. We should have a liberal image of us. But these people are keeping us back. And the problem is that the liberals don't confront them. I have spoken to a lot of people who are in power, that why they haven't confronted them, because they're afraid of these fanatic people, that they will come down on them in a bad way. So people just, for sanity, don't want to get involved and let them do what they like. But I feel that it is important that Muslims generally should take some interest in how we are projecting the Muslims in this community.
In Oxford?
In Britain, generally.
And
when I say talk about Muslims, I talk about Muslims in Britain mainly.
Anything else before we talk about Shaukat Khanum?
Not really, no.
Okay, so do you want to tell me about your work with Shaukat Khanum?
Yes, I went back to Pakistan. Umar also went with me for a few years when my mother got cancer and was dying.
I'm so sorry. When was that?
This was in 87, 88. We went back in 88 because she was dying and I want to spend time with her. So we went back in 88. And she passed away in 88. But then Umar had set up his research unit in Lahore, so he stayed on. And I met Imran Khan at a dinner party at a friend's house. And the friend introduced me to him. And his mother had died recently also. And it was in the news also that he was wanting to build a cancer hospital for the poor in Pakistan. So he asked me, he said, I've been talking to a lot of people, but people think it's not doable. What do you think about the project? I said, it is doable, but I would only help you if the rich and the poor are treated the same in this hospital. So he said, yes, that is my agenda also. So I joined him, and then we set up the trust and started working on it, started raising money. I started working, researching. I had never done this kind of work before, but Umar helped me into making a feasibility. He, went and researched different hospitals and found out how many patients we would have per year to treat, how many cancer patients in the country were, et cetera, to make the feasibility. And so for 2 years, I made the structure of it and helped with the fundraising also. The office consisted of one project director and one assistant and one driver. And we did the, you know, we managed. And we bought the land free for the country, for the hospital. So then when the time came to start the building, that was the time when people would make money out of it. Then everyone else wanted to take, be important and take the charge. So Imran's cousin came back from America to, wanted to come and help. And I thought he could deliver. He could. I wasn't bothered who made the building or who did what. If they followed what I had laid down, that it would be free for the poor people, and the care would be the same for the rich and the poor. So I was happy to hand it over to him then and say, okay, I've given 2 years to the project, now you carry on. And I'm pleased to say that it has delivered. It is. I feel proud of the project. I feel it has done well, and to this date, it has been working in a way that I feel proud of. That the rich and the poor, you don't know who's paying patient and who's a non-paying patient in the hospital. Everyone gets the same treatment.
Have you, after that, been working with them? Do you go back? Are you involved in any way with them?
Initially, I tried to go, but his cousin felt so threatened by me. He felt that maybe I've come back to take his position. He was the CEO of Barki, Jamshed Barki. Everyone knows him. So he was so afraid that he kept me waiting for half an hour outside his office, so that I just don't come again. So I understood what his agenda was. This is how people of Pakistani origin deal with their insecurities. And I hadn't gone for that reason. I'd just gone to see if he was doing the right thing. And I think he was doing the right things at that point. So I never went back after that because he felt threatened by me.
Have you noticed, you know, in the UK and in Oxford, amongst Pakistanis, a lot of support for Shaukat Khanum? You know, do people donate a lot? Are people involved?
No, I think people like Imran Khan and has donated a lot of money, but that's not what made the hospital. What made the hospital in one of the Board of Governors meeting, I had said that when we found out how much money is needed for it, because not just for the hospital building, the hospital for running it also, we needed an endowment fund to run it also. I had jokingly said that what Imran Khan needs is to marry 4 rich women with a big dowry. And when he married Jemima, I felt he's listened to me. One was enough. One was enough. He didn't need 4 because he was rich, and I'm sure his family contributes, gives charity to them, and that helped the running of the hospital.
But you have seen support here, yeah, in the community.
Yeah, of course, community. Yes, we have seen
that
a lot
people
of
really
want to help him.
Want to and give donations to Shaukat Khanum.
Yeah.
And that is something you've noticed in Oxford.
Yes, everyone wants to give money to him. Shocking. And that was my reason for joining him, because my own personal feeling was that what Pakistan needed was clean drinking water.
Mm.
That would have saved many more lives than what Shaukat Khanum is saving our prior. But I knew that Imran Khan could raise money. So I felt that this project could be made because he can raise money. So that's the reason I chose cancer. While there are other problems which need to be tackled first, I think clean water is most important. lot of children die because of the bad water.
Anything else you want to add? I know that we are at exactly
1 hour 30 minutes.
30 minutes.
I think there is lots to add, but you know, one could go in more detail how one got the land for the hospital. And now what I'm writing is not just about how Shaukat Khanam was made. I recently read his memoir. Imran Khan has written some kind of memoir, and in which he has not even mentioned my name. So I felt he doesn't even know how the hospital was made. So I need to put that in writing, how it was made. If Imran Khan doesn't know how it was made, then no one knows. And my feeling is that in Pakistan, because of this lackey culture, good people don't get credit for what the work they do. And that's why we are not achieving very much in government also. Nothing is done. Nothing is achieved. Because good people are not respected. And so I want to compare the making of that with the government he ran, because I think it's very similar. So the problems are the same. And the only good thing he did was he managed the COVID well crisis. And that was the reason was that he appointed the hospital CEO as the health minister. And Faisal Sultan is his name. He's a very good man. I've met him. And he's lucky that he's got him. So he was lucky that he got me in the initial phases to make the structure of the hospital. And now he's lucky that he's got a good, honest man who's doing a good job because it's a job and not to make money for himself. And so I want to say to the country, respect the people who do the good work and not just who pray 5 times a day. And he brought in an economist to help him who was a Qadiani, and they kicked him out. So these are not things which will make the country better. One has to rise above these things and choose the people who are good for the country. And there are lots of people who would do lots of things for the country. And I feel if any government does one good job, our country would be in a good place. If someone handled education, the next government comes there and handle family planning or something. No one has done any good. If I look at the governments in Pakistan, I don't see that they have achieved anything, solved any of the problems of Pakistan. The problems remain the same.